The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Administration of the land, and the government has gone on record saying that any private farmer, and keep in mind that as it was the case in Eastern Europe, the small section of private farmers are much more productive than the state sector. That's not news, you know, and the government acknowledges that. So because of the, particularly the impact of the food crisis internationally has happened, where the price of primary commodities, including agricultural goods, have gone through the roof, as we all know, everywhere in the world, not just in Cuba. And as a way of trying to compensate for that, the government has said to private farmers that if there is adjacent state land that is not under use, they can ask for it and it will be given to them in usufruct. That is not as private property, but to use it, very similar to the case of China. Now, in the case of China, that has led to unbelievable problems later on that I don't want to get into now, but we may want to talk about it in the question and discussion period. So, and we know that that has begun to happen. At the same time, the government dissolved all sorts of agricultural ministries that established a national central control. So they already have established the decentralization of agriculture to a considerable degree and opened the door, at least officially, for private farmers beginning to use state land in whichever way they wish, even though they will not be able to sell it. And they will not have property title to it, but they will be able to use it. I know it has begun to happen from accounts I hear from here and there. I don't think anybody knows the extent to which that has taken place, and here the extent is critical. The extent to which it will happen is critical here, and how things will unfold and so on. But the government is acting in a very pragmatic way. They have a serious food crisis in Cuba. By the way, the imports from the United States under the humanitarian exception to the blockade have skyrocketed into the hundreds of millions of dollars of imports that have now taken place from American food, but from the Midwest and West, because of the problems with Cuban agriculture. The sugar industry has been reduced to a shadow what it once was, and that has given way to a tremendous amount of idle lands that are not just idle but full of weeds because they have not been tended to. Something like 25% of state lands are now idle and full of weeds, and now they might be open for the use of private farmers. In socioeconomic terms, this could potentially be a Pandora's box with a tremendous impact on the very social structure of Cuba. So this is something to be watched, and in my opinion, is of the various changes that have taken place, certainly, potentially, is the most important. In the urban sector, nothing much has happened along the same lines. The government also announced, that there will also be social liberalization. What I mean by social liberalization is allowing much greater freedom of movement in Cuba. Both internally, that is, you cannot sell your house in Cuba to another person or buy, obviously, somebody else's house. You can exchange apartments or houses. There's a great deal of corruption in that and payments under the table and so on and so forth, but officially there is no, people are pretty much stuck where they live because there is no buying and selling of personal property. I'm not talking here about becoming a landlord, I'm talking about personal property. The same goes for vehicles, so that creates a great deal of immobility. And the government promised that something would be done on that as a response to these demands that were made from the population. And let me say, by the way, that even though the issue of not staying in hotels only benefits people that have access to hard currency, that was greatly resented, and rightly so, by people who didn't have foreign exchange and couldn't go to the hotels. It was a mark of segregation. It was a mark of apartheid. So that has great significance, symbolical as well as in real terms. But coming back to this issue, nothing has been done on the issue of people being able to buy themselves one's home, and particularly movement out of Cuba. To emigrate from Cuba is extremely difficult. It costs about $1,000, and that is, people depend on people from abroad to be able to get out of the country. You immediately The moment you say you're leaving the country, you lose your job. You have to turn over your house and every personal furniture, everything you have to the government. So it's extremely oppressive, the situation of immigration out of Cuba. They promised to make changes there. So far, nothing happens of that. Now, so these are, in a very brief way, some of the changes that have taken place. I think that they are consistent with the direction that I have been expecting from something, not only me, many people, but you know, certainly myself, of a move towards what we could call a Sino-Vietnamese model of view. That is a move to a one-party state, but opening more and more to capitalist-type methods. This is a very modest set of measures, significant but modest, but I believe they are consistent, particularly the removal of the top the salaries in Cuba. That is consistent with that road, although still in a very elementary, limited fashion. But nothing that has happened. And of course, and this is very important, while this economic liberalization and a little bit of social liberalization have taken place, and by social liberalization I mean things like freedom of movement and so on, nothing has happened in terms of democratization. Nor do I expect that anything will happen in terms of democratization, meaning the right of people to organize independently, to press their demands, whether workers, gay people, women, particularly black people in Cuba, where the racial situation is potentially a tinderbox. None of those affected groups of people are able to organize independently. They can, in the culture of the elevator, they can send their demands up, and then there will be a response from the top when the elevator comes down and brings down the response. It's a very hierarchical order. And of course, none of this, of course, the culture of the elevator doesn't open up to things saying, well, let's get rid of the one-party state. That's not included in the menu of what one can set up to the elevator. I'm talking about specific concrete complaints about selling one house, that kind of thing, which are very important, by the way. But it's limited to those specific requests for changes within the context of the system, obviously. So again, I think that it is pointing in that direction. Now, what is the context in which all of this has happened? And the context is, and this is what I said, the government is proceeding in a very pragmatic way. Because the context is that Cuba has still, almost 20 years later, has still not fully recovered from the massive blow that the collapse of the Soviet bloc meant to Cuba, certainly economically, in a matter of a couple of years, the gross domestic product fell by a third. You know, it was a massive crisis that was created in Cuba. There has been, you know, gradual growth. They reported from 2007, 7.5% growth in GDP in Cuba. Some people think it's exaggerated, but there has been some gradual recovery of the economy. Tourism, which somewhat declined in 2006 and 7, is doing apparently very well in 2008. There have been significant improvements in the delivery of electricity in Cuba, in part because of the exchange between Cuba and Venezuela, doctors, which has created a medical crisis in Cuba, by the way, but the exchange of Cuban doctors going to Venezuela in exchange for oil. There has been, blackouts have almost disappeared from Cuba, significant improvements in urban transport when they brought several hundred buses from China, which is one of the major trading partners of Cuba. But the situation, housing is still a disaster. There are serious crisis in the health sector, particularly the health sector that is not for the political elite or for medical tourism. So it's difficult to get anesthesia in Cuba. You know, everything is difficult, but particularly it's very, even more serious crisis in the educational sector. But there are crises in the two areas where the government has made the greatest progress, at least until 1990. And the education sector, there is a dramatic shortage of teachers because nobody wants to work for pesos, for the very low salaries in pesos that teachers get. So they have had to use television for classes. They have taken senior high school students to teach people in the lower grades, and there are all sorts of jokes about it, about, you know, 12-year-olds correcting the 16-year-olds who are teaching them because, you know, they know, some of them know better the material than the 16-year-olds. So it's a very serious crisis. And in fact, recently, just a couple of months ago, they took out this guy, Gallego Fernandez, or José Ramón Fernandez, an 85-year-old general, was put in charge. Of the minister of Education was fired, and they put out this 85-year-old general to try to reshape the education sector. So the area of education has been in a very, very serious crisis. And at the same time, there is a great deal of social decay in the society. Corruption is rife, as Castro, Fidel Castro himself made his speech of November 2005, when he said the revolution could be defeated from within. That's what Fidel Castro said then, because of corruption. There is a great deal of the issue of lack of discipline is in the Cuban press all the time, discipline at work, acts of what the Cuban press is their term, not my acts of hooliganism at sports events, which is a total unprecedented in Cuba, by the way. You know, this is, you know, in the baseball games, and apparently people getting into fights, and something that never happened, that or people throwing stones at buses in poor neighborhoods and so on. This kind of social, this is the kind of stuff you read more and more in the Cuban press. Now, this is sort of a, so far I've talked, the first part I've talked about the major changes that have taken place, the context in which those changes have taken, is a context of social crisis, not yet a full recovery. I think that the gross domestic product in Cuba is probably now more or less, a little less around where it was in 1990 after all these years. So that's the part one of what I wanted to talk about today. And then, of course, in the question and discussion period, we might want to go into more in detail or whatever, you know. On terms of part two, I'm happy to report that since the beginning of 2007, there has been a new mood developing in Cuba, a new mood that is expressed in events here and there. Still very inchoate, still very in its birth, if you will, but I think it's definitely something is afoot. And what I'm talking about is a change from the culture of individual complaint, that is people complaining and bitching about the problems they have in the daily life in Cuba, but on an individual basis, to something resembling more a culture of collective resistance. And I'm going to give some examples of that, which I think are collectively point to the beginnings of something new, beginning to coalesce. I don't want to exaggerate. Something is very beginning, but I think it's definitely there. At the beginning of 2007, there was an important protest of intellectuals and artists in Cuba, which was done through the mechanism of email. That is, that's how people organize themselves. It was a very modest protest in the sense that they were objecting to the fact that it appeared as if they were going to bring back some of the worst cultural commissars of the 70s, which was the period, the most repressive period, culturally speaking, in Cuba. And all of a sudden, these people started showing up in interviews in the press, and that, in those systems, that's a signal. When the people you never heard about for 20 years all of a sudden are being interviewed, so a big protest was organized. The government reassured the intellectuals and artists that no cultural change, which has been sort of, relatively speaking, a liberal cultural policy in Cuba since the 90s. And this protest didn't go very far. It never questioned, for example, who appointed those awful commissars when they were running the cultural policy in the Cuba. They didn't do that, especially with the micromanaging tendency of Fidel Castro. Major policies are not adopted just by underlings. Nobody raised that question, of course. But nonetheless, I think that protest was important, not in the depth of the political issues that it raised, which were not that deep, really, but that it was spontaneous. And that's what was most remarkable about it, that it initially developed totally through intellectual artists writing to each other in email and then beginning to create this wave. And the government was able to quiet that, channel it into safe channels, and sort of it never went too far. That's January of 2007. In September of 2007, something much more important happened, in my view, that very little has been talked about. And that is, there was a massive protest in the Universidad de Oriente in eastern Cuba, not far from Sierra Maestra, by the way, where hundreds of students openly demonstrated, complaining against the terrible living conditions they were living in and lack of security for women students. Apparently, there have been several rapes that had taken place on the campus, and the people were absolutely, in between the bad living conditions and the security for women students, people were really angry at the rector, and there was a demonstration of several hundred people, completely spontaneous, out in the streets in Santiago de Cuba. The Cuban press didn't say a word about it, but the Cuban press reported, and that's where I figured something important had happened, how the official counter demonstration organized in October 2007 by the government. Now, the Cuban government is not going to organize a massive counter demonstration a couple of weeks later unless it was serious what happened. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find out much more about it, but to me that's a very dramatic event that happens after a few months earlier, after the email protest of the intellectuals. And then after that, in January and February of 2008, two further incidents happened, one of which was widely distributed through the internet, and that is Ricardo Alarcón, one of the top Cuban leaders, being confronted at the elite information science university in Cuba that is located in Lourdes, which was where the Soviet station watching, you know, American satellite that was located. That place is now, after the Russians retired, they established an advanced computer university there, and Alarcón went to meet with the students, and he was confronted, and it was being filmed. And this guy, Eliezer Davila, who was one of the spokesmen, raised a whole bunch of complaints against the government, including the fact, many of them democratic complaints, that including the fact that they were the candidates to official parliament, that they didn't know who they were or what they stood for, anything like that, and they were being asked to vote for them. And all of this was televised. And Alarcón just made, if I may use the vulgarity, made an ass of himself in the complete sophistry and total inadequacy of the way he answered, and it was a major embarrassment to the government because all of this was being filmed and just got on the internet. You probably can find it. ICU, just put it in the internet, you probably can find it. Eliezer Davila, ICU, Ricardo Alarcón, January, February 2008, you can see it yourself, you know. And on the same time, just a couple of weeks before earlier, there was another incident where at a big meeting of the workers who work for foreign enterprises. But remember that when you work with foreign enterprises in Cuba, usually the joint ventures of the Cuban government foreign enterprises, you are being paid in pesos. The government is essentially pimping here because the government collects from the foreign enterprises, the hard currency, be it euros or be it British pounds or whatever it is, or being euros for the most part. They are collecting these monies in hard currency, and then they pay a part of that to the employees in Cuban pesos. What happens, these foreign enterprises, as a way of trying to get the employees a little happier than they were, began to pay them hard currency under the table. Like they would give them a little bit of hard currency unofficially to these employees. So now the government comes with the idea of taxing those under the table payments. So people were absolutely furious, and almost a near riot broke out at this meeting. And this happened around the same time as the thing that happened at the Information Science University, not too long after the thing at the Universidad de Oriente. So when I look at all of those things since the protest of intellectuals at the beginning of 2007 until today, I think I'm not a wild-eyed person thinking that there is a different mood in the country. And I think mostly it's that people are not afraid anymore. I think that's the underlying thing is more and more people have lost their fear and are willing to to raise a ruckus about concrete issues. And it's interesting to point out that these people at the Information Science University were raising all those demands from a revolutionary point of view. They were not raising it as with a right-wing ideology or anything like that, or capitalism. They were using the revolutionary point of view, raising these libertarian and democratic demands against the government. So there are other tendencies in Cuba we can talk about. I am not suggesting that this tendency has developed to any great degree. I think it's a beginning, and it should be seen as a beginning, as something that has potential. There are other much more powerful tendencies among discontented people in Cuba. Those very intellectuals I was talking about earlier, they tend to be, to one degree or another, pro-market. And this should be no surprise, given the same thing happened in Eastern Europe and the same thing happened in China. That is the typical reaction of many of these protest movements, particularly in places like China and so on, and also that was true in the Soviet, in the former Soviet Union, is a kind of pro-market liberalism. This, all the tendency promises something different, but it's not yet comparable to the liberal pro-markets, or for that matter, the anti-liberal pro-markets, because after all, those army people who are introducing these changes, they're in no way liberal at all. They may live with the liberals, the intellectuals, for a period of time, especially that implicit alliance between the pro-market liberals and the pro-market anti-liberals, that alliance may last for a while, to the extent that they can deliver on improvement in standard of living. There's nothing like an improvement in standard of living to cement an alliance, and if they can allow more freedom in and out of the country, which particularly for intellectuals and artists is a very important thing. And by the way, one, it's interesting, if you look at China and Vietnam, it's a lot easier. In spite of the incredible repressiveness, and the Chinese regime is a brutal regime, as we all know, in spite of that, it's very relatively easy for those who have access to the money to exit China and come back. Something that has only begun to happen in Cuba at the sufferance of the government. And this is an island, and people want to be able to come in and out without having to lose your house, your furniture, and certainly your job. So this is a new tendency that I think it's worth watching, and of course, that's where our hopes are. Now, let me look now, in the 10 minutes I have left, about the situation in the third issue, which is the situation in the elections and the imperialism in the United States. The blockade has been going now for almost 50 years. And it's one of the most disgraceful and criminal policies that the United States imperialism has adopted towards the country. And obviously, violating Cuba's right to self-determination, whatever lip service they've given to, quote, democracy, unquote. There is what is different now is that there is a block of people who are doing massive business in Cuba, particularly this year, by the way. I'm talking about the hundreds of millions of dollars a year of farmers, farm corporations in the United States, particularly in the Midwest, the South to some extent. Just a couple of weeks ago, one of the committees of the Alabama legislature, not the radical corner of the United States, one of the committees of the Alabama legislature passed a resolution asking the people in Congress to seriously to vote for any modifications of the blockade or elimination. This is the Alabama. Why? Because through Alabama ports are being used as a point of shipment for a lot of the food that is going to Cuba now, as well as canned goods. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars where Midwestern, Western farmers, some Southern farmers, are doing good business, and they can do even more because that trade is happening with the severe restrictions. For example, there is no credit that Cuba can obtain for it. They have to pay cash for that. So even as much as this, it could be a lot greater. So there's now a block of people in the U.S. Congress who are in favor, if not in eliminating the blockade, seriously modifying it. And if that happened, that would be the end of it, really. So the question is going to be, and in the past, under the second Bush administration, with this one, Congress was on the verge of, for example, allowing free travel to Cuba, not just for Cubans, but for any U.S. citizens, and Bush threatened a veto, and the thing did not pass. So the question is, whoever is now elected as president of the United States, what are they going to do if the Congress passes another? And remember, these are Republicans as well as Democrats who are in favor of that. This is not a liberal versus conservative thing. If anything, it's more of an economic sector thing than a political thing. That is the farm sector and the cargoes and the ADMs and all of those corporations are very much for doing business with Cuba. So what will the new president of the United States do about when Congress does that? Obama has gone on the record as saying that he is number one for maintaining the embargo, but for allowing Cubans to remove all the limits of Cuba sending remittances to Cuba and visiting the country, which has been greatly limited under Bush. And McCain is for doing nothing, for maintaining, not doing nothing, I mean for maintaining the Bush policy. At the same time that Obama is proposing this, the three extreme right-wing Congress people, Cuban Congress people in Florida, each one of them have Democratic opponents now who are supporting the Obama policy. So you have, so to speak, the right wing in Miami running against the ultra-right wing on the issue. And strangely enough, the right wing is the Cuban American National Foundation, and the ultra-right is something called the Cuban Liberty Council, which is even more extreme right-wing than the Cuban National Foundation. So it's right-wing versus extreme right-wing, you know. And the issue that is being disputed is removing the limits on visits of Cubans to this country. Now, United States policy will have an impact on Cuban development, there's no question about that. And in the last analysis, it's up to us, not just the people in this room, but people in the American left, more broadly speaking, and even if you're not a leftist, you are for self-determination of nations, that you don't really, you shouldn't need to be a leftist to be for that, but in reality, you need to be a leftist to be for that in an imperialist country. It is our job to make sure that America, United States, keeps its dirty hands out of Cuba and let the Cubans decide what is best for the country. So thank you very much.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.